I didn't want to miss that opportunity. Sorry, it was here. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm David Davenport, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and the former president of Pepperdine University, and I'm serving as your moderator for tonight's program. This program is part of the club's American Values series, co-sponsored by the Toby Philanthropies and the Corrett Foundation. And of course, you may find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, or you can download the iPhone and Android app for the program and the schedule information, as well as podcasts of past programs. And now it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, Dr. Charles Murray, a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and author of the new book, By the People, Rebuilding Liberty Without Permission. Dr. Murray is a political scientist, an author of both books and articles, and a libertarian. He grew up in a Norman Rockwell kind of family in Iowa, and then went to Harvard for his bachelor's degree, later earning his PhD at MIT. He spent 6 years in the Peace Corps in Thailand, and he says, "Most of what you read in my books, I learned in Thai villages," which is one question I hope to ask him about later. He's been a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute since 1990. He has written a series of important books exploring really big questions about welfare reform, race and class, education, and so forth. His latest book, released a week ago and highlighted in his own Wall Street Journal essay last Monday, is our subject for tonight's program, By the People, Rebuilding Liberty Without Permission. I think you'll find it very provocative and challenging. I hope it will lead to some stimulating questions and conversation. And so now please welcome Dr. Charles Murray.
Thanks very much. I am very glad to be back at the Commonwealth Club, which I think I first came to after Losing Ground came out, so that was about 1985. When I looked way different than the way I look now. I was also here, I believe, after the bell curve, one of the only civil discussions of the bell curve that ever occurred was at the Commonwealth Club. And I want to say that this is the first time I've talked about the book before an audience in which I don't have a home court advantage. This being San Francisco, I just got to assume that there are a lot of people in the room who are here not expecting to agree with me, but who are interested in hearing another point of view expressed civilly. And you all have my deep affection for having that attitude toward civil discourse, and I will certainly try to do my part tonight. I'm going to keep my remarks as brief as I can, and because it's a fairly good-sized book, that probably means 20 to 25 minutes. And then after that, David will have a chance to ask me some questions that have occurred to him, and we will have, I hope, plenty of time to have questions from the audience as well. Because the book raises a lot of very different kinds of topics, and it's hard for me to predict which ones you will find most interesting. I will give you an outline of the whole thing, and sometimes I will be telegraphic. I'm going to be saying things very briefly in hopes that then we can elaborate upon them as needed during the rest of the discussion. The book is written, unlike most of my other books, or all of my other books, it is not written for a general audience. My ideal reader for everything else I've ever written is somebody who likes to read the science section of the New York Times. That's the person I have in mind. This book is more explicitly addressed to people who I call Madisonians. So that includes libertarians. It also includes people who are devoted to the original constitutional concepts of limited government, but have non-libertarian views on social issues, but they don't want the government to legislate on the social issues. So that's the amalgam of people who agree with me in those broad principles that I'm talking to, and I'm saying a couple of things to them. The first thing is that the American project, as we originally conceived of it, is pretty much dead. I define the American project as the idea that people can be left free as individuals, as families and communities, to live their lives as they see fit, as long as they accord the same freedom to everyone else, with the government ensuring a peaceful setting for those endeavors, but otherwise stepping aside. As libertarians put it, you know, what the government needs to do is keep people from hurting each other and taking their stuff. And that's kind of a statement, a pretty good statement of what we think government should be doing. That's dead. And that's not an inflammatory statement. It's not a statement of despair. It's a statement of fact. We used to live under a presumption of freedom, that if we wanted to do something to our house, if we wanted to practice our vocation the way we wanted to, if we wanted to get together with our neighbors to solve social problems in a peaceful way, we could do this. And nobody was going to bother. We didn't have to ask permission. And now, as a statement of fact, we do have to ask permission for almost anything we do, as anybody in the audience who runs a small business knows, as anyone in the audience probably who's tried to do anything with any property that you own, you very likely know that. However, there is another consideration that others of us, including myself, are shielded from a lot of these ways in which the old freedom to do what we want has been circumscribed. The regulatory state doesn't really affect me because I work for the American Enterprise Institute and they have to deal with all that sort of stuff. Academicians also don't have to deal with a lot of this. Those of you who work for large corporations are buffered from a lot of this because you have departments within your corporation that have the sole function of taking care of all this stuff. But if you're talking about ordinary Americans who don't have those kinds of resources and those kinds of buffers, the degree to which the government at the state and the city and the federal level is now preventing you from living your life as you see fit, the extent of that has gotten quite extreme. Then the second proposition of the book is, though, that we can do something about it. And the operational plan, I will cut to the chase so you can have a context for the rest of my remarks. The operational plan is real simple. You identify regulations out of the 175,000 pages of the Federal Code of Regulations that are stupid or pointless, or that are enforced in stupid and pointless ways, and you make it possible for people just to ignore them. And how do you do that? You do that because they are backstopped by legal defense funds. And these are not legal defense funds that are restricted to defending people who are innocent of the charge against them. They will be defending people who are technically guilty of the charge against them. They have violated or ignored a stupid or pointless regulation. But the reason you want to defend them is that you want to litigate it to the max. Let me tell you this, the way that the book got written. This is a true story. This is why this book exists. My wife and I have a friend who runs a small business that, like most of the people in his occupation, hires almost exclusively Latino workers. All of his workers are documented. He's gotten them visas. They're here legally. He spends $20,000 to $30,000 a year on those visas. He pays for their airfares. He pays good wages. He's a model member of the community as well as being a model employer. And he has been harassed relentlessly by the federal government because there are all sorts of niggling little things that he had where he hasn't followed the rules. And sometimes he has been guilty of not adhering to one regulation because he really can't. He can't follow it. Such as, for example, he's supposed to have more native-born American workers than he has, and he can't get native-born American workers to work for him, and so he's fined for not having enough of them. Well, anyway, there was a series of these things. It cost him a lot of money and trouble, and at one point he said to the person from the regulatory agency, I am going to fight this in court, to which the bureaucrat said to him, you try that and we will put you out of business. And he knew that was true, and he knuckled under. And that made me so mad, truly angry, that I told my wife I just didn't want to hear any more about this because it was too upsetting. And then I had my epiphany. An image, I think it was on horseback. A guy in a pinstripe suit on horseback appears from nowhere, taps the bureaucrat on the shoulder and says, we are taking this man's case. We are going to defend him with all of the resources available to us in this crazy legal system we have, which means we are going to make a lot of trouble for you. And at the end of it, yeah, you'll find him guilty because he did, in fact, not comply with your regulation. But when you do find him guilty, and you fine him, we're going to reimburse his fine. That was what came to me. And then after that, I thought, why couldn't you do that on a big scale? You have the Legal Aid Society that defends poor people who have legal problems. How about if you had a large legal defense fund that took on people like this, ordinary Americans, took them on in large numbers and litigated the cases to the max, created as much publicity as they could for the cases, and reimbursed the fines? And what do you accomplish by this? You provide some disincentive for the bureaucrat to enforce a regulation where the violation has not caused anybody any harm. The number of examples of this are legion, and I'm hearing more and more of them as after the books come out, but I'll give you one that's in the book. A brick-making company was fined $7,500 because they did have railings on stair landings that were exposed and people might fall otherwise, but their railings were 40 inches high. And the OSHA regulation says they should be 42 inches high. They did not have a sign saying poison on a shed. The shed contained beach sand. But beach sand has been classified by OSHA as a poison because it might cause certain ailments in certain grinding operations, none of which occurred at the brickmaking factory, but they didn't put a poison sign on it. Okay. These are not outrageous exceptions that hardly ever occur. What happens with the regulatory state is they have inspectors come in, and they each have their favorite three dozen regulations that they remember, and they're different ones for different inspectors, and they basically just go around and find these kinds of silly violations and pursue them. What you want to do is give them a reason not to do it. You're familiar with the sports saying, no harm, no foul? In sports, you have, in the NBA, for example, a philosophy that if a foul occurs but it doesn't affect the action of the play, you just ignore it. That's what I want to force the regulatory state kicking and screaming to do, to adopt a no harm, no foul, that they enforce those regulations that, in fact, involve a serious issue where the harm occurred because the regulation was ignored. And I should emphasize at this point, my wife tells me that I've got to make sure I say this every time. I am not against all regulations. When you have regulations which mean that the tunnels in which coal miners work are soundly constructed, that's great. I'm talking about the 42-inch railing kind of regulation. Okay, so that's the bottom line. That's where I want to go. That's the systematic civil disobedience. But you can't just say, let's go out and be systematically civil disobedient without giving some very thorough reasons for that position. The rule of law is the foundation of civilization. To take the decision to systematically ignore certain aspects of the law has to be justified. And so the first five chapters of the book lay out that argument. The essence of the argument being that the normal political process cannot roll back the power of the state that it has taken unto itself to interfere with living our lives as we see fit. The first chapter talks about the ways in which the Constitution has been inextricably changed from its Madisonian origins by Supreme Court decisions that cannot be reversed, even if you had 9 Antonin Scalias or 9 Clarence Thomases on the court, because to reverse those decisions taken from 1937 to 42 would mean that 90% of what the federal government does is unconstitutional, and no court could issue that decision because it would never be enforced and the court's legitimacy would be shattered. The second chapter talks about all the ways in which the legal system is becoming lawless. It's very ruleful. The legal system is very severely constricted by all sorts of rules, but it is increasingly looking lawless to those of us who encounter it for reasons that I argue are inextricably embedded in the use of law to advance social agendas. Next chapter specifically goes to the administrative state, what I call the regulatory state. I don't know about this audience. I was ignorant of how the administrative state worked. I did not realize that when you violate an EPA or OSHA or Department of Energy or one of the 70 other regulatory agencies' rules, you don't go into the regular court system. You go before a judge who is appointed by the EPA, if the EPA is had violation. The prosecutors are employees of the EPA. If you are found guilty of violating the regulation and you take it to a court of appeals, the judges in the court of appeals are employees of the EPA. It's an extra legal system. Furthermore, I didn't realize that you don't get legal support paid for by the government. You don't get a presumption of innocence the way you do otherwise. It's the lowest of all the standards of evidence. Just a preponderance of evidence is all that's required. All sorts of due process rights that are available in the legal system are not available to you. I didn't know any of this stuff. It's sort of as if the police force could create laws, then stop people for violating them, and then choose the judges and juries and appeals courts that ruled on those violations. Fourth chapter is about the systemic corruption that now paralyzes a lot of what goes on in Washington. I don't mean that we have more venal or less honest politicians than we used to. I'm talking about systemic corruption, whereby, operationally speaking, all of the things that happen in a kleptocracy are the way that business is routinely done in Washington. Such as, in a kleptocracy, you simply cannot talk to an official with power without giving a bribe. In Washington, you can't get the ear if you are a corporation or even a small business or an advocacy group. You can't get the ear of a senator or a representative unless you make a significant campaign contribution. In all sorts of ways, we have a system that operationally operates as a kleptocracy, and the significance of this for rolling back the power of government is it ain't going to happen. Fifth chapter in this uses the work of Mansur Olson to talk about the ways that advanced democracies develop sclerosis in their functionings in ways that seem to be endemic to all advanced democracies. So that lays out the groundwork where I say, look, you can still get important improvements in policy on discrete policy issues through the political process. You can have improvements in educational policy, tax policy, welfare policy, or that kind of thing. But if you're talking about removing the reach of government from our lives, the only way you can do that is through the kind of systematic civil disobedience that I then in the second part of the book lay out, which gives all the details of the Madison Fund for defending violators of regulations with which I began my presentation. I should add to just mention a couple of other things that are in that second part of the book, because you don't pick regulations at random. I talk about the criteria that need to be applied in selecting regulations that can legitimately be ignored. I also describe the ways in which you are trying to reach a point at which, well, here's the analogy I use. I want the regulatory state to face the same issues that face state troopers when they are out on the highways. As all of you know who drove into town today on the freeway, if there wasn't a traffic jam, the flow of traffic was considerably faster than whatever the speed limit is in the state of California. But the state troopers were not stopping everybody who are going 5 or 6 or 7 miles over the speed limit. They are stopping people who are really going way faster than the speed limit or who are driving erratically. And that's the right way to do it. So I want to have a regulatory state in which all regulators behave the way that state troopers do. I also, in that part of the book, say it's not just a philanthropic organization like the Madison Fund that can defend ordinary Americans. You could also do this on an occupational basis. There's no reason why dentists, for example, could not say, look, the American Dental Association has very high standards of professional practice, and we will have an insurance fund in which dentists contribute a couple of $100 a year to the fund. And in return, the ADA says to dentists, If we find that your practice is being run according to the professional standards of the ADA, we will defend you against violations of government regulations that are stupid and pointless. And we will also reimburse your fines. You could make government, in other words, into an insurable hazard, sort of like tornadoes or locusts. We don't build our houses so that they are tornado-proof. We buy house insurance. And in fact, the risk of being inspected by OSHA or EPA or one of the other agencies are relatively small. But right now, you can't afford to ignore the regulations because the odds of being inspected are small, but they're not zero, and you can't afford to take the chance you're going to get hit with $25,000 in fines. By paying into the insurance fund, you effectively are freed from having to worry about those regulations because you have bought insurance. Part three is in many ways, I think, the most interesting part of the book. It's entitled A Propitious Moment. And I call it a propitious moment because in many ways, I've spent the first five chapters talking about everything that's gone wrong and the ways in which our government has become paralyzed in some cases and tyrannical in others and just plain crazy in still others. But at the same time, there are other ways in which this is the best of times, in which there are all sorts of possibilities opening up that weren't there before, that will lead in the direction of greater freedom for people to live their lives as they see fit. I have, for example, a long chapter on cultural diversity. The conventional wisdom right now says, well, the United States was this homogeneous Anglo-Saxon British population, and yes, in the 19th century we had other whites come in from Europe, but they were assimilated into this Anglo tradition, and now in the 21st century we are about to become a nation in which whites are the minority, and we have an unprecedented case of cultural diversity. And that the chapter basically says that's nonsense. The United States was incredibly culturally diverse even at the time of the Revolution, because the Scots-Irish and the Puritans and the Quakers and the Cavaliers had radically different cultures. As all of those of you who have read a book called Albion Seed, wonderful book, will know. In the 19th century, this was a Balkanized country with German states. I mean, Wisconsin and Minnesota and Iowa and some of these were Scandinavian Germanic in very important ways. You had a variety of cultures that were riotously different during that time, and the cultures which were tolerated within the borders of the nation as sort of a matter of course for what it meant to have a free society. That the really anomalous period in this country was the middle of the 20th century, when we'd not had immigration for a long time, when we had mass media come onto the scene, which meant that almost everybody was watching the same TV shows and going to the same movies, and there was an illusory sense in which we were becoming culturally homogeneous. Now we are culturally heterogeneous again, but in very interesting ways. I'll give you one quick example. The phrase states' rights in the 20th century was a code word for segregationists who wanted in the South who wanted to be freed from federal efforts to enforce civil rights. Well, states' rights is taking on a very different meaning in Colorado and in Washington State with the passage of those marijuana laws. Those marijuana laws, you understand, are completely unconstitutional. The Constitution opens with a statement that all doesn't open with it. The principle that federal law trumps state law is just absolutely universal. There are no exceptions to it. But the Department of Justice says of those marijuana laws, well, we aren't going to bother you as long as you adhere to certain broad guidelines. That's a case in which now San Francisco is the poster child for this. There is a way of life in this part of California in which people who live here want to preserve that way of life. They don't want people messing with it, and that includes they don't want the federal government messing with it. There are lots of those cultural pockets. Wanting to have less oversight from Washington is no longer the province of one small section of the political right. It is increasingly shared by people across the spectrum. That's one of the kinds of things I introduce. The other is the notion of the role of technology in making all kinds of government oversight increasingly obsolete. In 1900, it made a lot of sense for the government to pass food inspection laws. It was really hard for consumers to know what was going into food. Food drug labeling laws made a lot of sense. Consumers had very limited ability to know what was going on, and the government was one of the most efficient ways to have that happen. Now we have access to so much information of so many kinds. Suppose that the government tomorrow said we're not going to inspect meat anymore. It would be suicidal for Safeway to try to sell contaminated meat. It would be all over the internet in a matter of days. Instead, Safeway will start promulgating and publicizing its much more strict standards that it employs than the federal government ever asked. Similarly, local tyrannies that used to be able to exist without the federal government having a role was a serious problem, whether it was maltreatment of African Americans in the South or whether it was company towns where local tyrannies could exist. Today, local tyrannies are red meat for every news department in the country, and they are exposing them is one of the major ways in which you build audience, whether it's on local news shows or whether it's on 60 Minutes or the many other kinds of investigative shows. I'm making a broad statement about the degree to which the information revolution has given ordinary Americans immensely more accurate and real and valuable information about all sorts of things that it didn't have a century ago. The second way in which technology is just beginning to open up possibilities for rolling back the power of government is the ways in which we can sidestep the government. Uber. Uber does not ask permission to open its services, begging the city council to let it enter into the cartel that the city government and the taxi cab industry has established. Uber just goes in and starts operating. And by the time the cartel tries to get its act together and stop it, this is certainly the case in Washington, D.C., Uber was already so popular that the politicians realized that there was a political cost to outlawing Uber. There were too many people who wanted to use it. Airbnb, the service that provides places to stay outside the hotel industry. It has more rooms for people to stay, I am told, than the entire hotel industry in the entire world. You couldn't have conceived of Uber or Airbnb 15 years ago. Similarly, we cannot conceive now of all the ways in which you're going to have similar kinds of workarounds. Yes, the government will still be there. It'll be like this massive whale, but it's not going to be something that needs to intrude upon our lives nearly as much as it has in the past. And I will add to that my long-term optimism based on a couple of things. Suppose that over the next couple of centuries, we have continually increasing wealth, which is the most plausible scenario. Not necessarily, you know, we could have Soviet-level stupidity in the management of the economy, but short of that, we'll have vastly increased wealth per capita. We will have technology that makes today's technology look primitive in terms of its capabilities. It's inconceivable to me that in a world with that kind of wealth and individual empowerment, people will still say, gee, the best way to run a country is with an armies of bureaucrats enforcing thousands of minutely prescriptive rules. I just don't believe that's going to be true a couple of centuries from now. And another chapter in the book tries to lay out some of the mechanisms by which I think an evolution back toward individual and local freedom will emerge. Well, I will close this very quick overview by saying why I think this is so important. I am not under the impression that the United States is the only great place to live in the world. I've lived in Thailand for many years. I have an Italian son-in-law, and I could easily imagine myself making a wonderful life for myself in Italy, or for that matter, in half a dozen other countries that I know, let alone all the countries I don't know. But the United States has been unique. We are the only country in the history of the world that was founded on a charter of limited government, the only one that's ever done it. We were the only country that actually sustained a limited government over the first century and a half of its existence, with lots of problems, with lots of defects, but problems and defects that we were working on solving. No other country followed our example that was formed after the United States. No country that was formed before the United States amended its own charter to be more like us. If the American project, the idea that people can be left with a presumption of freedom, if that dies, it's more important than if the culture of any other particular country dies. In this sense, something unique, a unique way of life, will have been lost. And we are currently in the process of that way of life being on life support. Some people have responded to my arguments in the book by saying that it will be dangerous, that it might undermine the legitimacy of government, that in many ways what I do may jeopardize some of the grandeur and the majesty of the government, to which I say that I don't really care about the American government being majestic or being grand. The American project was special because it made us the land of the free, imperfectly but increasingly over the first couple of centuries of our existence. I am not frightened of losing majesty or grandeur in America. I am very frightened about the extent to which we are in danger of losing America's soul. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dr. Charles Murray, scholar of the American Enterprise Institute, author of the new book, By the People, Rebuilding Liberty Without Permission. And it's time now for our audience question period. And I came with a few questions, and you have supplied from the audience many questions. So we'll see how many of these we can discuss with Dr. Murray. Charles, a lot of people believe, I think, in sort of the pendular view of history, that things swing to the left for a while and then they'll swing back in a corrective way to the right, or maybe a President Carter tacks in one direction, but then he's followed by a President Reagan who tacks his sailboat in a different direction. It seems like you're not much of a believer in that, or you think it's run out of gas, or what's your view of the pendular approach to history and whether that's enough of a corrective now?
No, why? I reject the pendular view of the American history emphatically, because if you go back, now was it Federalist 10 or Federalist 51, where Madison has this great passage about if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If we were governed by angels, then we would not need to restrain government. The great problem in creating the American Republic was how to first enable the government to control the people and second oblige the government to control itself. In my view, what the Supreme Court did in a series of about four or five key decisions from 1937 to 1943 was to fundamentally unleash the government by first saying, well, the enumerated powers no longer enumerate the powers of the federal government, that this phrase general welfare that introduces the enumerated powers is a good enough reason for the government to spend money. Once you said they could spend on the general welfare, a huge barrier on the power of the government was released. When the Commerce Clause was redefined so that it embraced agriculture and manufacturing, as well as just buying and selling across state lines, and when it was increased so that indirect effects were sufficient to qualify as interstate commerce, that radically increased the variety of things the federal government could regulate. And then a much lesser known decision, I think, was just as important, and that was National Broadcasting Company versus the United States in 1943. This is the decision where the Supreme Court decisively changed its doctrine, which previously had said Congress can't just pass legislation asking for pie in the sky and then let the administrators figure out how to do it. You had to have an intelligible principle whereby the regulatory agencies or any agency in government was carrying out a clear mandate of Congress that had, in the phrase of the court, intelligible principles. And in 43, the Supreme Court said no. It was enough that the FCC tell NBC that its licensing rules that the FCC would employ would serve the interests of fairness and so forth. Well, making up regulations that ensure fairness depend a lot on how you define fair. Implementing laws that say we need clean air, can be done in a whole lot of different ways that can be rationalized. So in those three areas, the federal government was given powers vastly greater than it had ever had before. Didn't immediately change everything. But then in the 1960s, under the Johnson administration, the government began to run with it and began to take advantage of this expansion. So no, it's not pendular. We fundamentally multiplied by orders of magnitude the power of the federal government from 37 to 43.
So I think most people would say if we've had a limited government Madisonian president in our lifetimes, it was probably Ronald Reagan. What do you think Reagan was able to accomplish in terms of limiting government? And do you not think there's room for somebody like that to be elected again and accomplish some of what you think needs to be done?
Reagan didn't do much of anything in rolling back the power of the regulatory state, and he couldn't. Look, what the president can do with regulatory agencies is remove the Secretary of the Interior on some specific issue, saying you've got to interpret legislation this way or I'm going to fire you. Yeah, theoretically can do that. But we all know that it's not the secretaries of the agencies that control what the agencies do. It was what goes on in the bowels of the agency. And no president can say, oh, I'm going to define the Clean Air Act or I'm going to define some other act of Congress the way I see fit, and so you guys can no longer write regulations enacting that legislation. That's not within the power of the president to do. So no president, no matter what his ideology may be, can really do anything to rein in the regulatory state.
All right. I'm trying to explore whether there are any solutions short of what I think has surprised people in your book, a libertarian, more conservative, limited government guy asking for civil disobedience. That seems to be a bit of a surprise. A couple of the questions have related to that in particular. For example, one question was, well, presently you either violate a regulation or you don't. If we move to your no harm, no foul standard, wouldn't that create a lot more discretion and lawsuits and judges and questions? And wouldn't it open the door to more corruption? Somebody's got to decide whether there's been harm or not.
First place is a very good point. And I would recommend that people get Philip Howard's most recent book, The Rule of Nobody. Philip Howard has written The Death of Common Sense and a couple of other really good books. He's writing from the political center. In many ways, I think he considers himself philosophically a liberal, but he's very upset about what's happened. And he says this fear of giving discretion is has gone way too, talk about pendulum, it's gone way too far in one direction. Here's really the problem. The regulators have said if we spell out everything in detail, that will get us where we want to go. Take something like nursing homes, for example. Nursing homes are heavily regulated. And if the regulation was you shall provide a humane, nurturing environment characterized by these conditions, which, by the way, is the way that regulation in Europe is oftentimes written, that would be one thing. When you say that you're implementing a humane, caring environment by saying you shall spend X number of minutes with each patient, each resident each week, that's not advancing that. Here's one I heard of recently. A bartender was fined $3,000 for failing to card a patron at a bar. Now, the purpose of carding, of regulation say card, is to prevent underage people from drinking, okay? So one would think that the reasonable way to enforce that is this bartender, it was a she did not card this person, and this person was 18 years old. The person she was fined $3,000 for not carding was her father, age 54. She had violated the requirement to card, completely ignoring the intent of the regulation. Now, I am not dismissing problems associated with giving administrators regression, giving them the ability to interpret discretion. What I'm saying is that we have gone so far in the other direction that we have to return to a principles-based regulatory regime, in large part because we get counterproductive results in some of the important areas where we need regulation. The report on the Three Mile Island partial meltdown sort of expressly and in detail talks about the ways in which incredibly complex regulations had reduced the safety of the nuclear plant. And that's happened in a wide variety of environmental issues as well, where the effect is not to help the environment, that you get counterproductive backfiring effects.
Let's take a current, very hot issue out here in California, which is our drought, and the imposition of an emerging, pretty heavy regulatory scheme to deal with that. So, for example, if you live in a county that's already using less water than average, you might only have to cut X percent. But if you live in a county that's already using too much, you might have to cut even a larger amount. If you don't cut to the appropriate level, you may face fines. How would a limited government person who's worried about building too much into a regulatory state, how could you do that in a Madisonian way? Can you bring that home to us to California and how you'd approach something like water and control
maybe
of water?
Maybe charge the market price for water?
Mm.
Water has a value.
Right.
You pay for it. My libertarian heart is being exposed here. I don't think dealing with the drought problem is difficult at all. You charge the market price for water.
And I assume provide some base level for people who can't afford
We will not have people dying of thirst.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, good.
That's
we
okay.
Got a little,
That's
we
okay.
got a little exception out of you there, which I appreciate. One more California question while we're at it. We're in Silicon Valley, and Silicon Valley has disrupted a lot of the rules and practices of business. You mentioned Uber in your remarks. Don't you think technology might ultimately force some of the kind of changes in government that you would like to see?
Well, I gave some examples about how it can work around government. I think that rather than forcing government to change, government will simply become, in a lot of ways, obsolete. How many of you in the last year, we don't have to put up your hands, but I'll just ask the question. I bet a lot of you have gone to WebMD or other kinds of websites like that when you've had symptoms or health problems or other kinds of things. There are lots of different resources out there. And then how many times did you go to sites like WebMD as opposed to go to the website of the Department of Health and Human Services or some other government website. How many of you went, let's just face it, the government's websites are just lousy. they're hard to use. They're not very informative. And we aren't going to get them to take down their websites, but nobody's going to use them. And in a variety of other ways, a whole lot of things that the government does will continue to happen. But I'll give you a quick little, just a little anecdote. I was talking with a senior executive of a utility company, which technically speaking are very highly regulated. And he started talking to me about this, and he says, actually, in a lot of ways, we just don't think the government's very relevant anymore. They figured out the regulatory game. They're a big enough corporation that they can do it, and they're already living their lives as they see fit in important ways because they're big enough to get their way, whereas you or I as individual citizens can't do that.
Let me move through a few of the audience questions, although I've already touched on some of them. This audience member said, helmet laws save society the large cost of head injury, but such laws infringe on individual rights. What's your view on the laws and regulations like helmet rules, for example?
You know, that's the kind of issue that I call the child pornography issue. With libertarians, when you get midnight bull sessions among strict libertarians, they can go on for a long period of time about, when is it appropriate to restrict people from children from doing things and this sort of thing? So should child pornography be legal? And my attitude toward that is, oh boy, do we have a lot of things that we can do before we reach that point? And so if you're talking about the motorcycle helmet laws, the libertarian in me says, look, let people ride without the helmets, and if they are in accidents and so forth, let them pay for their medical care because, you know, they asked for it. But the reality is that everybody say, well, but that's, you know, all the reasons why you shouldn't do that. And I say, look, I'm going to have a whole lot of regulations that are stupid and pointless that people ought to be allowed to ignore before we get to motorcycle helmets. And maybe I should spell out my overarching criteria for whether people, for a regulation that qualifies for civil disobedience. I have specific criteria in the chapter on this, but I say the overarching one is this. If a citizen is charged with violating this regulation and the case is publicized, will an overwhelming majority of Americans be on the side of the defendant? In the case of the motorcycle helmets, it won't be an overwhelming majority.
Yeah, it'll be a split.
It'll be probably an even split. I don't know how it, but there would not be the overwhelming majority. And so on purely practical grounds, I wouldn't want to do that because it's really essential that the systematic civil disobedience be something that taps into a very broadly shared American perception that I think includes a lot of moderate people on the left as well as the right, that the government has just gotten out of hand, that it's interfering in things that are none of its business. So let's stick with the things on which there's a consensus of Americans that say they shouldn't be going after this guy for that.
Let me take just a moment and say you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is conservative commentator Dr. Charles Murray, who's discussing what individuals can do to fix broken government. I'm David Davenport of the Hoover Institution, your moderator. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. Continuing with some good audience questions, should there be regulations of the finance industry in particular, and would you comment on what kind of regulations you think there make basic common sense and on the other hand, are excessive?
I'm hesitant to answer because I'm not an expert in that field. Let me try to break it down and and here's a non-expert answer. Is some regulation of the financial industry warranted? I think yes, in practice. Theoretically, the market should punish people who do stupid things in the finance industry, and those should go out of business. In practice, there is an awful lot of collusion that can go on that is very damaging, crony capitalism, and a variety of things where the market is not particularly efficient or effective. So is there any regulation? Yeah, there should be. Is something like Dodd-Frank, which is an enormously complex law, is that the way to go about it? I would say in a broad framework, no. In part not because of the details of the law, in which I'm not competent to comment, but because of a larger problem. When you have a very heavy regulatory burden, it works to the advantage of the large corporations. The head of J.P. Morgan, I guess, is it J.P. Morgan Chase now? I can never keep track of the mergers. Let's say it's J.P. Morgan. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of it, is on record as having said of Dodd-Frank, it creates a bigger moat for J.P. Morgan. And he went on to say that smaller banks simply cannot cope with the requirements of Dodd-Frank, and it inhibits them from competing in the marketplace. And one of the things I think we really, really need in the finance industry, as well as every place else, is lots of competition so that if people are doing stupid things, smarter other competitors will not do those same stupid things and introduce the discipline of the market onto them. I also think that collusive capitalism, which is my term for capitalism in which corporations are in bed with the government, is very destructive economic growth, among other things. And it's also violates a fundamental rule of fairness, which is, look, free enterprise needs to be competitive free enterprise. And collusive capitalism is a form of trying to gain an unfair advantage. Adam Smith is the one who said that when you get three or four business people, businessmen and in his time, together, that one of the first topics of conversation will be how they can form a monopoly position and gain an unfair advantage over their competitors. And a great deal of making this wealth-producing goose that lays the golden eggs to continue laying the eggs is that it has to be competitive and it has to be fair and free. You have regulations that push toward that. You do not have regulations in which the government says, you're our pet. We will give you an unfair advantage.
At the Hoover Institution, I inherited the office of Milton Friedman, highly quotable, and he said on one occasion, business people believe in free markets in theory, but they're always happy to have a little subsidy or regulation in their own particular field.
I should add something for those of you who are not of my political persuasion. I assure you, I am really tough on the right. In this book, and in fact, when I'm talking about systemic corruption in Washington right now, a couple of my most dramatic examples are of the Republican-controlled Congress from 2000-2006. So when I'm talking about systemic corruption in the government, this is not code word for the left. It's I am an equal opportunity trasher of systemic corruption in the government.
Well, and this is a good chance to bring forward this question from the audience. Did you find enforcement of regulations in the cases reported to you and in your studies of regulation, did you find enforcement of regulation to be on a partisan basis? Are there partisan problems in your understanding of the regulatory system?
Leaving aside the recent stories about the IRS, no. No sense of that at all. What you have with the regulators is, first, I've lived in the Washington area for 40-odd years. I've known an awful lot of people who work for the government. They are as good parents and neighbors as anybody else. They are not evil people. The inherent problem with the regulatory state is that when you give people the power to say, you have to do this, with the force of the state behind you, it seems to be human nature that people like to exercise that power. And so I'm sure that the bureaucrat who said, you try that and we'll put you out of business, is not an evil person, but he's a person who has been given the force of law to say to another human being, I can tell you what to do. And it just seems to be that they like to exercise that power.
This questioner wants to join you and maybe expand your program a bit. He or she says, excellent suggestion to have a litigation fund to discourage charges of stupid laws. How about a coordinate program that creates pressure on legislatures to overturn stupid laws and or refrain from passing new ones?
Okay, here's where we learn from the wisdom of an economist named Mansur Olson. He was at, University of Maryland for most of his career. He wrote two seminal books. The Logic of Collective Action came out in the mid-60s, and The Rise and Decline of Nations, I may not have that title exactly right, in the early 1980s. And his essential argument was this, that in a democracy, in an advanced democracy, you have an asymmetry of interests. Use the sugar subsidy to make the point. You're aware that we Americans pay about twice the world price for sugar. And the reason we pay twice the world price for sugar is because of government policy, which is instituted at the behest of a very small number of sugar farmers. Government has attempted at the federal level to get rid of this subsidy for years, including just a couple of years ago, with Republicans dominating both houses of Congress, couldn't do it. Came real close, couldn't do it. Here's the reason why. The sugar farmers really care about that sugar subsidy, and they will go to enormous lengths with lots of donations and so forth to sustain that, whereas the rest of us would kind of like to pay less for sugar if somebody brings it to our attention. This is not going to be a consuming interest for us. And so the special interest wins because they care so much more. That's why it's so difficult to get rid of any government program, no matter how outmoded, no matter how unsuccessful, because there is a constituency that really wants that, and the opposition diffuse. Well, the upshot is there are rewards for maintaining that program, and there are penalties for voting to get it out. And when you have that situation, you're not going to get rid of things. I don't see any prospect whatsoever for electing what I would call a Madisonian majority, because most Republicans are not Madisonians, as I'm using the term. The people who think as I do about the role of limited government will never be more than 10, 15, 20% of a Congress.
That leads to a very appropriate question. I suspect I know the answer to this. Probably only those of us who work in think tanks can really embrace and advance the radical thinking that you have advanced, but this person says, do any of the current candidates for president support your approach to civil disobedience or oppressive regulation or candidates for Congress?
Well, I certainly recommend that they not say so publicly. Jeb Bush, I guess, a couple of weeks ago said that he likes my books. And I think that it was soon brought to his attention that's a pretty stupid thing to say. No, so even if
politically.
politically, a stupid thing to say. Rand Paul, I am sure, in principle, would be drawn to this. But the likelihood that anybody is going to say, look, coming out and saying, hey, I think that an idea of systematically ignoring large chunks of the federal legal code is a good idea. You don't say that if you're running to be president of the country or if you're running to be a governor. That's why the book is called By the People, Rebuilding Liberty Without Permission. Mm. That's the only way it's going to happen. Our elected leaders are never going to do it.
Yeah. Having spent almost all my adult life on college campuses, I resonate with this question from the audience. Libertarian and Madisonian ideals are no longer taught in schools and colleges in the U.S. In addition, for recent immigrants, libertarianism is a foreign idea. What are the prospects that libertarianism will remain an important part of our political culture?
Well, it's not going to, there's going to be a different kind of socialization of Americans in the future, and I guess there already has been for the last 50 or 60 years. If you were to have 20-year-olds ask them about the Minutemen, ask them about Valley Forge, ask them a whole bunch of things that used to be iconic parts of our identity as Americans, what percentage are going to know what you're even talking about? That's going to be a very small percentage. Among immigrants, it's going to be still smaller. These things are not taught in K-12, whereas they used to be the core of the curriculum. And so when I started on the book, I was actually kind of depressed, thinking that the question there, the answer is, it's pretty much gone. This kind of devotion to the American, the unique American idea of limited government. I'm not so sure of that anymore. The affection, I'm hesitating because I, you know, it depends on what side of bed I wake up on, whether I'm deeply pessimistic or I'm optimistic. But doggone it, almost all the immigrants that I run across, including illegal ones, are more American than most Americans. They're working a couple of jobs. They're absolutely convinced they can make a better life for themselves and their kids. And they're optimistic, and I say, well, they're acting like Americans. In a lot of ways, it's we native-born ones who, I think, are increasingly comfortable with a society that is like Europe's. And, hey, you know, countries in Europe are nice places to live, and who've lost a certain kind of patriotism, whereby the land of the free, meant very explicitly, was coincident with patriotism, whereas now patriotism is more inclined to be wave the flag, America number one, but divorced from that land of the free aspect. So in the course of answering this question, the last few minutes I've gotten depressed again. So.
But you seem like a cheerful guy, so yeah. Surely it won't last. Well, I have a question here that relates to this. Your book is already starting to get a little bit of online commentary, which I looked at, you know, reviews of your book then allow comments afterwards. And one online comment was right along those lines, and I'll quote, "Is it just me, or is Charles Murray getting angrier and more frustrated as he gets older? His new book reveals Murray at the end of his rope." And so my question is this book kind of your what I would call no country for old men moment where, you know, if you've seen the movie or read the book, you know, Tommy Lee Jones finally realizes his six-shooter just isn't enough for all the drug money and weapons, and he just kind of puts it down and says, I don't know what we're going to do now, but have some civil disobedience and go sue them all.
And I'm looking at the number two there. Does that mean we have to be done in 2 minutes?
We have 2 minutes left. That's right. Okay. This might be our last question.
Okay, so we'll treat it that way. This book is much more angry than books I've written in the past. Mm-hmm. The story that got me started on it made me really angry. And I am, this is my best attempt to try to do whatever I can do to preserve a new incarnation of the American project. But let me remind you that in the long term, I'm optimistic. In the long term, humanity is not, as it advances, is not going to say, oh, let's live lives in which we do what everybody else tells us, what people in power tell us to do. So in that long term sense, I'm optimistic. It's going to be very sad if we get to that goal, maybe worldwide, and America will long since have ceased to be what made it special. So that, in a very personal sense, I will be sad about that. But on the other hand, by that time, I will have been dead for a long time. So, you know, I could live with that.
Excellent. Our thanks to Dr. Charles Murray, scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, author of the new book, By the People, Rebuilding Liberty Without Permission. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's American Values Series, co-sponsored by Tobey Philanthropies and the Corrett Foundation. And we want to remind you that copies of Dr. Murray's book will be on sale, and he'll be pleased to sign them in the fireside room following the program. I'm David Davenport, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.